from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Linda Birnbaum directs National Institute of Health's National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and the National Toxicology Program. She joins us for this half hour to talk about matters related to health and toxicology and much more. Good to have you here. Thank you for joining
us. Thank you, Michael.
I guess a place to begin is with breast cancer, particularly with all this talk now about mammographies and just how important they are for women of certain ages and so forth. This is still, we ought to mention, that is breast cancer is still the leading cause of cancer death for U.S. women between the ages of 20 and 59 or 21 and 59, although I believe that lung cancer is a much bigger killer overall, at least certainly in the world and in terms of whatever age. Have you taken a stance on this? Has your group taken a stance on mammography?
Well, the recommendations of the NIH are that women should discuss this matter with their own private physicians. In many ways, this is an issue of personal choice, and depending upon their own history and their own risk will determine what they should do.
The NIH is pretty much on board then with most of not only the task force, but what has been recommended here.
I think that's correct.
What about, you know, we've done a number of programs on the environmental factors with breast cancer or how they contribute to, and I know that, you know, there's still a lot of attempt to sort out the genetic and the hormonal and the environmental, but what do we really know at this point? Do we know anything more about environmental causes in breast cancer?
There are many different environmental chemicals that have been associated with breast cancer. I think some of the things that we do know, we know that, you know, genetics play a major role, but not the only role, because in fact, if a woman's sister or her mother or her grandmother on the maternal side had cancer, she has a higher risk. But that doesn't mean she will get breast cancer. We, in fact, are doing a study which we hope will help us elucidate what are some of the additional genetic factors and some of the environmental factors that will contribute to the risk of breast cancer. We've recruited 51,000 women from many centers in the United States who are sisters of women who have breast cancer. And we are following them for 10 years. We are taking repeated medical examinations of these women. We're taking biological samples and we're taking environmental samples and very careful history of these women over the 10-year period. Some of these women will go on to develop breast cancer. Most will not. But and we are hoping that this will not only shed light on what some of the environmental factors are, but potentially lead us to develop some new screening tools that we'll be able to use to identify those who are most at risk.
It seems it's so difficult, though, to find incontrovertibly the connection between the environment and something like breast cancer. And in fact, at this point, there's a lot of, well, hazarding of guesses, frankly, going on. There's this thing called the precautionary principle, which I'm sure you're familiar with. In fact, I'd like to have you on air say what you think about
it. Well, I happen to be a supporter of the precautionary principle when it's defined appropriately. And by that I mean is that you act in the presence of uncertainty. It's not that you act in the absence of any information. But when you have information which is concerning, you don't wait to have every I dotted and T crossed before you make a decision.
Maybe we ought to explain a little bit more about what you understand the precautionary principle to be, because what I understand it to be is you got to be afraid of anything that may be, in fact, carcinogenic or may cause concern where cancer is.
I think that's a complete overstatement, and actually there's been some disinformation about what precaution means. Again, precaution means that you act when you have information concerning information. It doesn't mean that you act when you have total absence of information.
In many instances, though, a lot of that misinformation is being disseminated, what you're calling misinformation. There are a whole list of things that are said by various organizations, many of them nonprofit, many of them well-meaning, to be sure, ought to be avoided at all costs.
I think, you know, we as a society are very adverse to risk, or at least to risk that somebody else forces upon us. You know, we take risks all the time. People smoke, people drive their cars, people ride bicycles without helmets, all of which are risky behaviors. But those are things you do to yourself. We don't want somebody else to impose a risk upon us. And so at times, I think we overreact. There are many chemicals that are out there both naturally occurring as well as synthetic chemicals, which have the potential to cause harm. Many of these chemicals, or I should say actually really very few of the chemicals in commerce, have ever been tested extensively. Almost a very, very small number have been tested extensively. However, if a chemical is shown to have a multitude of effects in several different animal species, it is highly likely that some people in our population will be susceptible to its effects. So some of the questions you might want to ask is, well, is there exposure to this chemical? Who is exposed to this chemical? How much are they being exposed to? And then make a educated decision about whether the potential risk is worth the benefit.
Well, let's talk with you about some of these things. BPA, to start out, where are we in terms of what we know at this point?
I think what we know is that there are hundreds of scientific papers now, well-conducted papers, which show that exposure of animals to BPA during development have long-lasting effects on the reproductive system, on the nervous system, on several of our other biological systems. There is also some evidence, and I should say that these effects are occurring at levels in the animals that are similar to levels that are present in the human population.
FDA doesn't seem all that concerned, though. Should they be?
I think FDA is relooking at the entire issue. I've had a number of discussions with some of the leadership in FDA, and they, in fact, are looking at some of these new studies. Many of the studies I'm talking about, the hundreds of studies, have come about in the last 10 years. You know, in science, we have a tendency to look under the lamppost. And when you start shining the light elsewhere, you start finding other effects. Now, there are a number of well-conducted studies that do not see these kinds of effects in animals, but they're not the same studies. They're not using the same animals. Animals may be a different strain or a different species or from a different source on a different diet, and all those things can modify the response.
And these confuse the public.
It's very confusing to the public. And I think the things that we need to understand is I can give you a rat, for example, a strain of rat that will always get breast cancer. And I can give you another strain of rat that will never get breast cancer. And if you ask me which strain is representative of the human population, the answer is both. Because there are some people in our population who are very susceptible and some people who are not. So I think some of the confusion in the experimental literature with BPA or many other chemicals is that people are running the studies differently, and they're using different animals, different strains of animals, different species. And we need to understand that just like not all people are the same, not all laboratory rats are the same either.
Talking with Linda Birnbaum, who again is director of the Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. They're a division of the National Institutes of Health dedicated to understanding how the environment influences the development and the progression of disease. And she'll be giving a free public forum, 7 p.m. at Cavallo Point Lodge in Sausalito. That's tonight, I guess.
That is tonight.
What about, let's talk about risks of a number of things that the public would like to know more from your perspective about plastic additives.
Talking about BPA or talking about phthalates?
Well,
or
we're talking about other things. We talked about BPA, but I mean in general. There are, as you say, contradictory kinds of experiments and contradictory research, and that goes across the board, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and I think that that's the way that science moves forward, is that you have different kinds of information, it gets evaluated, and over time consensus builds. I think the issue of plastics is an extremely complex one. Plastics have in many ways improved the way that we all live. On the other hand, we all know that plastics can cause problems in the environment as well. We know there are huge dead zones in the oceans, for example, which are related to all the plastics that have been released into the environment as opposed to being recycled. But some of the plastic additives that have concerned people are the things like the phthalates. And there is quite a bit of evidence that some of the phthalates can affect the development of the male reproductive system. And if this occurs early in life, it's not reversible. And so there are permanent effects that lead to demasculinization.
That's what's happening to frogs all over, we're told, at least.
Well, I think the situation with frogs is very complicated. You know, just like we're beginning to understand that chronic diseases like diabetes and heart disease and cancer don't have one, there's not one gene, there's not one cause.
Multifactorial.
And I think the same thing is true, for example, if we're looking at the crash in amphibian populations. It's not just one thing.
What about if we're looking at lead and mercury? I mean, even on that subject, there's controversy and
disagreement. There is some. If we take lead as an example, one of the most public health protective measures that ever was taken was the removal of lead from gasoline. And we saw blood leads drop dramatically within a year of the ban of lead in gasolines. That's a real success story. However, we're also beginning to understand that even levels of lead below what used to be thought of as a no effect are causing effects during development. We're beginning to understand that lead, not only in very young children, but in adolescents, still has an impact. And some recent papers have just come out demonstrating that lead, which is stored actually in the bones of adults, are associated with changes in blood pressure and cardiovascular disease. So we've known since the Roman times that excess lead is a problem. What we're beginning to understand is that there is no safe level.
We also understand that we need more research and tougher times. What you're, I think, didn't $35 million in research funded last year for the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences?
Well, no, our $35 million is what we have spent on breast cancer and the environment.
I'm sorry, that's what you spent on.
In 2009.
What was your funding total?
Our total funding for our institute, not counting all the money we got under the American Recovery Act, the stimulus package, was about $760 million in 2009. And that includes both our basic funding for all the environmental health work, but we also have a Superfund research program that supports information, understanding the hazards of Superfund sites and how to clean them up. And we also are the group that provides the worker training for emergency and hazardous response workers across the country.
Let me give out the phone number. I know there are many of you who would like to join us with questions or comments about the impact of environment on our health. Linda Birnbaum is director of the Institute of Environmental Health Science. That's part of the National Institute of Health. And we're discussing a whole range of things, plastic additives, lead, mercury, connections between the environment and cancer, and reproductive health. Haven't even mentioned asthma, but that's a whole probably hour in it unto itself. But we do welcome your calls, and you can join us toll-free, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-6786. Those lines are available for your questions or comments. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or send us an email, and you can do that as well. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. As we learn more, Linda Birnbaum, about environmental causes of diseases, what about the regulatory arms? Are they sufficiently going to keep up with the science?
I think you understand that NIH is a basic research organization. We are not regulators. However, through the National Toxicology Program, several regulatory agencies sit on our executive board because, in fact, our mission in NTP is not basic biomedical research, but is to coordinate the toxicity testing across the federal government and actually do some of those studies. So we work very closely to provide information that FDA, that EPA, that CPSC, that OSHA can use in making regulatory decisions. At the moment, there is growing interest in reform of some of the regulatory laws related to environmental chemicals. We're going to have to see how that plays out over the next couple of months.
Let's see what our callers have to say or ask. Hugh, you're first up. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for the topic. Nick Kristof in the New York Times has had a series of articles about endocrine disruptors in pesticides and herbicides, and most herbicides and pesticides in the past have been graded, whether they're household or for farming, on toxics. I'd like to know, first, what your guest thinks about the subject. Secondly, whether these can't be tested before they're introduced, like Europeans do, as opposed to being introduced and then tested for endocrine disruption.
I think you've raised a very interesting issue. The whole issue of endocrine disruption kind of sprang or was formulated starting about 14 or 15 years ago when we began to realize that multiple environmental chemicals could affect our hormone systems. And if you think about the role of our hormones, they're supposed to maintain our balance, our basic homeostasis. So any kind of perturbation, too much or too little, is going to affect that balance and potentially cause a problem. Much of the original testing of pesticides was looking at high levels of exposure, and we were looking for frank effects on obviously looking for things like lethality, but also things like often neurological effects that we would see, for example, in animals. What we're understanding now is that you can affect the endocrine system at very, very, very low doses. And so we're beginning to, the regulatory agencies are beginning to ask for those kinds of tests. Now, we have different laws that determine what the regulations are. And under FIFRA, which is the Federal Insecticide, Rodenticide, and Fungicide Act, there are certain requirements for testing. And pesticides have to be re-registered every, I don't know exactly how many years, where new data is looked upon. Unfortunately, chemicals that are sold for commerce that are not specifically pesticides or herbicides, if those chemicals existed prior to 1978 and the passage of the Toxic Substances Control Act, there is no requirement for those chemicals that were grandfathered in. I think that is part of the discussion that is going on in the halls of Congress right now about the need for potential reform of TSCA, so that maybe we should begin to think about the kinds of approaches that are being used in Europe under the REACH program, which is requiring the producers to provide toxicity information on the chemicals that they would like to sell.
And let me thank you for the call. Getting back to the precautionary principle, that's pretty much accepted standard in Europe, isn't it?
I think the Europeans use the precautionary principle appropriately. When they have information that demonstrate that there is a problem, they will act even though they don't have the certainty that a problem will occur.
We'll take more of your calls, and we go to Carla. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. In my childhood, I lived in an agricultural community, and I'm sure that we were exposed to DDT and other chemicals. I'm in good health, except I think I experienced some hormonal disruptions, around years ago, possibly as a result of that. What I'm wondering is, people who live around golf courses and in agricultural communities, are you taking measurements? Are you noticing that they have elevated risk, or do they experience measurable hormonal changes or increased rates of cancer? That's my first question. The second is, can you make a comment about mercury in regard to tuna and the other large fish? I mean, people are still eating it. It's still in the stores. What's the risk there? I don't think there's a minimum dose of mercury that's safe.
Well, actually, we had a guest on who wrote a book about mercury who really ascribed many, many sicknesses and illnesses to mercury poisoning. In fact, saw it as sort of the opposite of a panacea. It was the cause behind or the ideology behind so many diseases.
Me take the mercury first, yeah, and then go back to the issue of pesticides and hormonal effects and living around farms or golf courses. So the issue with mercury is many states have fish warnings about levels of mercury. And in fact, the recommendations are that essentially there should be no shark, tilefish, swordfish, and king mackerel eaten, and tuna should be eaten. I believe the recommendation is not more than one tuna steak a month, and the recommendation is, I think, no more than twice a week of 3.5 ounces of the canned chunk kind of light tuna. Now, because of the mercury, personally, I think that developmental exposure to mercury can be an extremely serious problem. Mercury does build up in our bodies. I think it's absolutely appropriate that children and women of reproductive age try to avoid known sources of mercury. And we know that, remember that mercury is produced from a number of different kinds of energy sources. It's produced in certain mining. Obviously, mercury has been around a long time. The mercury that you're getting from fish is a different form than the mercury that's emitted into the air. But what gets emitted into the air gets into our waterways and then gets transformed into the organic form of mercury that can cause the developmental problems. So I think, some of the people who had really high levels of mercury were people in the San Francisco area who were eating a lot of sushi.
Yeah.
And I think many people have listened to some of the warnings and cut down on their consumption. Now, back to the issue of, are there effects of people who are living in farming communities or around golf courses? There are a number of studies that are going on. Several have some preliminary results. We are part with the National Cancer Institute and the EPA in conducting a long-term study of agricultural health, agricultural farm workers and their families. And there are a number of...
It's a study that began when?
That began at least, I want to say, 15 years ago and is still ongoing. And there are a number of effects that are being seen with a number of pesticides in that study. In addition, there are quite a number of other studies that have been, that are still in progress, looking at health impacts of living in areas where there may be heavy pesticide or herbicide use. And there are concerns about the long-term exposure, for example, to DDT, as well as many other kinds of pesticides.
You look at, and I thank the caller, you look at these longitudinal studies, and what's so aggravating and frustrating about them is can't be incontrovertible, and they go year after year without necessarily really proving in an incontrovertible way.
It's very difficult in human epidemiological studies to prove that something is causal. What you find are strong associations, and when in fact you find those associations in multiple studies, and when you find that there are experimental animal studies that find the same thing, then the animal data kind of provides the biological plausibility to support the human findings.
But that's a key word, isn't it? Plausibility. I mean, again, to prove empirically some of these things is really very formidable and challenging.
We don't want to intentionally expose people to chemicals that we think
could be bad. No, I wasn't intimating that you should.
Right. But I think that's the reason that it's very hard to have proof. I mean, look how long it took to prove that smoking could cause lung cancer.
Exactly the thing that came to my mind. Plus, often you're dealing with rodents and so forth, and they don't necessarily translate into the human species.
People want to tell you that. But I would argue that while, rats aren't people, in fact, people are animals. And if we find effects in multiple kinds of animals, and we find effects in a number of different tissues of those animals, it is highly likely that there will be some people in whom we can also find effects.
And on we go to more calls. We go to Mountain View. Glenn, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. Something I've been curious about for a long time is the percent of smokers who get breast cancer. For example, lung cancer is like 90% are smokers. What's the percent in breast cancer?
I think the association between smoking and breast cancer is not clear. I'd say 20 years ago, we thought that women who had smoked when they were teenagers did have an increased risk that did not return to baseline if they stopped smoking. I'm not positive about how strong the association is between breast cancer and smoking today. We know, obviously, that cigarette smoking is associating with a multitude of health, not only several cancers, but many other health effects, however. But I am not aware of a specific number that I could give you or how strong that association is between breast cancer. I think when we look at breast cancer, we need to be thinking about what happened 20, 30, 40 years ago, because the breast is a very dynamic organ. And what happens during different developmental times in the breast, whether it's before birth, whether in the infantile period, whether during puberty, or for a woman during pregnancy, can all alter her susceptibility to exposure to a carcinogen later on.
And I thank Len for the call. Let me go to just a couple emails here. Teresa says, please ask the speaker why the precautionary principle has not been applied to the herbicide atrazine, a widely applied pesticide for which concerning estrogenic and anti-androgenic effects have been shown in every vertebrate class study to date.
I believe atrazine is a very interesting compound. A number of years ago, the concern with atrazine was for breast cancer based upon some animal studies. Those studies turned out not to be necessarily relevant to people. However, since then, there has been a growing wealth of data starting about maybe 10 years ago, certainly within the past 2 or 3 years ago, demonstrating that developmental exposure to atrazine in several rodent species and other vertebrate classes does cause permanent adverse effects on multiple organ systems. And I believe that the EPA is relooking at some of the atrazine data right now.
Another question from a listener says, much of our food, fresh and canned, is now imported from other countries. What safety provisions are in place to make sure the pesticides, which are banned in the U.S., are not being used on food imported from Mexico, China, et cetera?
That's really an issue for the FDA.
Yeah, that's out of your bailiwick.
That's out of my bailiwick, but I think the whole issue of food safety and the levels of chemical contaminants in food is something that could use more attention.
That's said very diplomatically and prudently, if I may say so. Another caller joining us, Ron. Hi.
Hi. It's an interesting subject. For over 3 decades, I've been focusing on toxic chemicals with Global Garden and Hope and Beyond, and I have a very interesting question. Since some chemicals attach to fatty tissue, and therefore they're bioaccumulative, banked in our bodies for a number of years, those chemicals that are there receive new chemicals that are banked. What are we doing about extracting the bioaccumulating, interacting chemicals that are also have transgenerational effects?
Well, Ron, that's a loaded question. And I think I'm going to break it up into several parts. First of all, fat-loving chemicals do go into our fat. If they are very slowly metabolized, they will also persist, so the concentration will increase in our bodies over time. I think what you are asking is, if you have multiple fat-loving chemicals, do they interact? And the answer is, sometimes they may. We don't really know.
The answer is it depends.
It depends. Yeah. I think there is growing evidence that if chemicals affect, say, a same organ system, there is the potential for them to act in an additive fashion.
That's going to be the end of this half-hour segment. Thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Linda Birnbaum. She'll be at Cavallo Point Lodge in Sausalito tonight at 7 p.m., free public forum. Again, I appreciate very much you being with us. And again, she's director of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences and National Toxicology Program and Institute of the National Institutes of Health. We are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11, another hour coming up. Novelist Barbara Kingsolver joins us in the hour ahead. I hope you will join us for that hour. Thank you for being with us. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.